The Fertile Crescent in the Middle East has long been known as the cradle of civilization and the birthplace of agriculture. But now we know that agriculture was a global invention. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, the origins of agriculture around the world and in Iowa. Recent archaeological finds demonstrate that cultures all over the globe were developing agriculture simultaneously. I'll talk about those finds with Bruce Smith, curator of North American archaeology at the Smithsonian Institution, and Iowa archaeologist Cherie Hari Arts. We'll also talk about human impact on the climate and the earth through the ages. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. For generations, students were taught that the Fertile Crescent in the Middle East was the cradle of civilization and the birthplace of agriculture. But in recent decades, archaeologists have found evidence of a much more complicated and interesting history. This hour, we'll talk about the origins of agriculture around the world and in Iowa. And to start off the hour, Bruce Smith is here with me, curator of North American archaeology at the Smithsonian Institution. Hello, Bruce.
Hi, thanks for having me on your show.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And of course, a lot of us learned that story about the Fertile Crescent when we were in elementary school or in junior high. What is the evidence that led to that telling of history?
I think it was because the Near East is certainly one of the centers of plant and animal domestication that's produced the widest range or variety of domesticates that we rely upon today. So pigs and goats and sheep and cattle and wheat and peas were all initially domesticated in the Near East. So that's one of the reasons that it has long been thought of as the cradle of agriculture. And also because a lot of the archaeological work that gave good results was first done in the Near East. But now, particularly over the last 15 or 20 years, people have been doing a lot of research, both genetic and archaeological, in a lot of different areas of the world. And we're finding that there are a number of different, maybe 10 separate independent centers of plant and animal domestication around the world.
Wow. Well, and let's focus on the Fertile Crescent for just a little while longer. When was the archaeological research done that led to that lesson that we all got in elementary school? When was the Fertile Crescent discovered by archaeologists?
Right. The first real systematic or programmatic archaeological research specifically looking at the origins of agriculture and initial domestication was done by an archaeologist called Robert Braidwood in the 1940s. He was from the University of Chicago, and he had some ideas about where the first evidence for plant and animal domestication would be found, and went out into the Near East and excavated a number of sites and did, in fact, find evidence for very early domesticates.
And what kinds of evidence did he find?
Plant and animal remains. And basically what he did was locate settlements that he thought dated back to when plants and animals were probably first domesticated about 10,000 years ago, and excavated them and looked at what the settlements looked like. They were relatively small but sedentary in that they were occupied probably year-round and over a long period of time. And then specialists in plant and animal remains, archaeobotanists, archaeozoologists, analyzed the plant and animal assemblages from those sites and built arguments supporting the idea that they were represented domesticates rather than wild species of plants and animals.
And I'm sure that really was such an incredible discovery at the time. And again, you know, that story has been told so many times. But let's move to some of these other sites around the world that now we know agriculture also had its origins in. Tell me about one of the other sites.
Sure. At about the same time that Robert Braidwood was working in the Near East, another archaeologist, Richard Scotty McNeish, decided to find evidence or was interested in finding evidence for early plant domestication, particularly corn, in Mexico. And he began in northeast Mexico and didn't find very early plant remains from the cave sites that he excavated there. So then he went farther south to the Tehuacan Valley, and there he excavated a series of dry caves and found evidence for very early domesticated maize recovered from those deposits. So Mexico is another major area we think of as producing domesticates, in that corn and the common bean and also one species of squash were brought under domestication initially in southern Mexico.
Well, and I think...
Also, probably along with the Near East, one of the other independent centers of plant domestication that's best documented is eastern North America, where we know now that before corn or any other Mesoamerican domesticates made it up into the eastern woodlands of North America, Native American societies there had independently domesticated four, maybe five different local species of plants.
Which also tells us that, one of the other stories we've been telling for so many years is also probably not accurate, and that is that there were all of these plant domestication processes that had taken place in Mexico, and that Native people had traveled and shared these crops throughout North America.
Right, and that did in fact happen, but it happened at a much more recent time period. We have a pretty good idea now, for example, of the sort of travels or the history of diffusion of maize first domesticated in southern Mexico maybe 6,000 to 7,000 years ago. We know that it reached the southwest United States at about 4,000 years ago, but it didn't then cross the plains and reach eastern North America until right around the birth of Christ. So, and beans didn't make it to eastern North America until around AD 1200 or so. And squash, Cucurbita papos, is the species, was actually domesticated twice, once in Mexico, and then the same species was independently domesticated in eastern North America. So we do have, and one of the things that's attracting a lot of researchers these days, both archaeologists and geneticists, is sort of tracking the history from first domestication up through diffusion of different domesticates, plants and animals, into different areas of the world.
And let's talk about a very different environment. Let's talk about Borneo and some of the evidence for early agriculture there.
Right. In the New Guinea highlands, we know that that's where bananas, for example, were first domesticated. And there we find it was a very puzzling site, Kuk Swamp, K-U-K, at a very high altitude in New Guinea, showed evidence not so much of, we didn't recover, or there wasn't any evidence of domesticated bananas recovered, or actually any settlements, but they saw, the archaeologists uncovered evidence of drainage canals and other water management systems that suggested that they were cultivating tree crops at high elevations in the New Guinea highlands maybe 6,000 years ago. And that's before any domesticates from other parts of the world arrived. So a quite different sort of set of domesticates, and also a quite different set of initial conditions under which domestication took place.
It strikes me as very interesting that when we tell the story of the birth of agriculture, we theorize about why people would have started growing crops. And all of these different places around the world seem to have sort of different reasons why people would have started growing crops. And talking about Borneo, I mean, there's evidence that one of the earliest things that the people who lived in these forests did was burn the forests, which theoretically made it easier to hunt. And that was part of the process that led to agriculture, right?
Right, exactly. We have good evidence, and some of the earliest evidence is in island Southeast Asia, where it's clear that human societies there were burning the forest maybe as early as 30,000 years ago. And that goes along with, if you think about domesticates and humans bringing plants and animals under domestication, they're actually intervening in the life cycle of these species and manipulating them and encouraging them selectively. But this isn't a sort of a unique invention that's limited to a few number of species. And within a larger context, humans were beginning at the end of the Pleistocene and early Holocene, about 10 to 11,000 years ago, worldwide were auditioning and looking at a wide range of different species of plants and animals in their environments and trying to figure out how they might improve their reliability as a food source and also increase their productivity as a food source. So within this wide range of different species of plants and animals that were being auditioned in different parts of the world, some really responded to the efforts of humans to increase their productivity and reliability, and they went on to become domesticates. Other species weren't quite as amenable to being managed in this way, so they would continue to be managed in largely controlled so-called natural environments by humans, but never became domesticates. And then other species that didn't have much of a food value would be actively discouraged. So domestication, we now think, emerged within this broader context of ecosystem engineering by human societies in a lot of different environments worldwide.
Well, and we think about an agricultural revolution taking place, but it sounds as if it was a much more gradual process than that in most places around the globe.
Yes, that's one of the, if you think about the origins of agriculture as a general topical heading, and then under that you have, particularly in the last 20 years or so, an explosion of different individual specific research questions or puzzles that archaeologists and geneticists are looking at. So you can trace the domestication history of individual species. You can also look at a particular region and all of the different species that were domesticated and what the timing and the sequence of it was. And also what happens is that the initial domestication of plants and animals and the subsequent development of agricultural economies is now, we know, separated by thousands of years.
And we're going to have to pick it up there in just a moment. We're taking a short break. I'm talking with Bruce Smith of the Smithsonian Institution. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the origins of agriculture around the world. In the last couple of decades, archaeologists have made discoveries that lead us to believe that agriculture was independently invented at least 11 different times on 4 different continents around the world, not just in the Fertile Crescent in the Middle East, like so many of us learned way back in elementary school or junior high. With me this hour, Bruce Smith, curator of North American Archaeology at the Smithsonian Institution. In just a moment, Cherie Howery Arts, an archaeologist and education and outreach associate with the Iowa Office of the State Archaeologist, will join us. And you are welcome to join the conversation as well with your questions. The number to call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Bruce, just before the break, we were talking about how instead of an agricultural revolution, there was much more, and still is, an agricultural evolution going on where there would be significant advancements made and then maybe 1,000 years would pass before things would change dramatically. Again, we also, I don't know, when I think about agriculture, I think about fields. You know, of course, I live in Iowa. I think about fields of corn and soybeans. But this early agriculture would have looked very different from the kind of agriculture we think of today. Can you give me a frame of reference for what we're talking about when we talk about evidence of early agriculture?
Sure. Certainly, first, you can separate initial domestication from the subsequent emergence of what you would think of as agricultural economies by thousands of years. A good example is in Mexico, squash was domesticated about 10,000 years ago, and it was the only domesticate populations had there for another 3,000 to 4,000 years, and then they added corn in as another domesticate. But larger villages that archaeologists think might have been based on an agricultural economy don't emerge or appear in the archaeological record until about 4,000 years ago. So you have thousands of years where there are essentially hunter and gatherer populations that get most of their food supply from wild species of plants and animals, and they happen to have a few domesticates. And then after thousands of years of that sort of low-level food production, then you have a transition or the emergence or development of agricultural economies. And then a second issue is, how do you define agriculture? How much of the, what percentage of your annual caloric intake do you have to get from domesticates before you qualify as an agricultural economy? A good part of that puzzle could be illustrated by, in Eastern North America, we usually think of a transition to maize-based agricultural economy occurring at around AD 1000. That's when we see large settlements appear that are fortified with temple mounds and plazas and stuff. And we can look at chemical signatures in human bones and know that the relative importance of maize went way up. But they didn't have any domesticated animals in Eastern North America all the way up to a European contact. So they were agricultural, you could say, but they didn't have animals. So domesticated animals, they relied on fish and white-tailed deer and other species. So archaeologists still debate, you know, what is the archaeological signature of agriculture. And usually it has to do with more permanent, larger settlements, larger populations in one place, and evidence for storage of food crops, evidence for domesticated herds of animals at some substantial level. But it's really hard to find evidence of fields, per se, until you get right up until European contact, and there are descriptions of maize hills and things in the northern Midwest, for example.
So we're thinking about this early agriculture, small garden plots, perhaps, if you want to take a modern equivalent.
Yes, you would have a good example would be if we went back about 3,000 years ago in eastern North America, there were small settlements. First evidence for cultivation of local seed plants in eastern North America. And the settlements would have maybe 5 to 10 families living in small structures, probably on a year-round basis, with storage pits and earth ovens and other cooking facilities. And they would be hunting a wide variety of different species of animals, fish and clams and white-tailed deer. They would be harvesting a lot of different species of wild plants, including nuts, hickory nuts, and acorns, and wild grasses. And they would have small garden plots of probably mixed together of pinopodium or goosefoot and Iva annua or marsh elder, sunflowers and squashes and bottle gourds, but not really contributing a great deal to their diet at that time, maybe 20 to 30% of their diet.
And you have said in the past that you feel that the first farmers, there's evidence that maybe they weren't pulled into agriculture or experimenting with cultivation out of need, but more out of curiosity. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's for a long time, right up until the last 5 years or so, most of the sort of theoretical frameworks for explaining why people first brought plant and animals under domestication was one of need, that there was an imbalance between their dietary requirements and what the environment around could provide. And that was either caused by environmental depletion, that somehow climate change and the environment went downhill, or population growth was also a popular one, that human population increased to the point where they had to domesticate plants and animals to continue to support their growing population. But if you look at these early settlements in eastern North America and the Near East and in Mexico and other areas where you see the first evidence for cultivation and domesticated plants and animals, the environments, rather than being sort of marginal, are in fact very rich environments. These people have their settlements located in environmentally and resource-rich river valley setting, and the population levels seem quite small, so that it doesn't appear that necessity is the mother of invention in this situation. What it looks like is happening is that the human populations are exploring and auditioning species across their environments to see which ones might be yield a higher yield if they're encouraged a little bit. And that's one of the basic characteristics of human populations, is the knowledge of their environment early on and passing on that environmental knowledge from generation to generation, and also managing or taking care of the environment as good stewards of the natural environment in which they live, and constantly trying to improve them so that they can get a better and more predictable yield. So I think, at least, that early domestication of plants and animals was essentially the development of a buffer or a supplemental part of their diet that went along with the hunting and gathering economy that really didn't change much for thousands of years after these domesticates first appeared.
It also changes my idea. When I think about these early societies, the hunter-gatherer societies, I often think about how incredibly difficult life must have been. This was a subsistence-type existence. But the way you're talking about this kind of changes my idea of that, thinking, well, you know, if these societies were prospering as their civilization was developing, there were people who had time to pursue their curiosity in this way and really follow in what was an intellectual pursuit as opposed to a necessity.
Absolutely. And these hunting and gathering populations settling in rich environments would have had a central permanent settlement that they lived in and would have been occupied over hundreds of years by a related group of individuals through kinship. And they would have had a very well-defined resource catchment area moving out from that central settlement. And over hundreds of years, they would get to know it intimately. They would know where the good clam locations were along streams. They would know where wild species of plants and animals tended to hang out at different times of the year. They would know where the hickory groves were and would encourage them. So as long as their population didn't grow beyond the carrying capacity of this local resource catchment area, they could have a very sustainable, very relatively healthy lifestyle over a very long period of time.
I'm talking with Bruce Smith, curator of North American Archaeology at the Smithsonian Institution. We're talking about the origins of agriculture all over the globe. And I want to bring Cherie Howery Arts into the conversation. She's an archaeologist and an education and outreach associate with the Iowa Office of the State Archaeologist. Hello, Cherie.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, and Bruce has been talking at various times about his area of specialty, which is the northeastern United States. And in looking at agriculture and its early development in Iowa, I hear some parallels between that story. But let's
Certainly.
Talk about what we know about when agriculture first arose in Iowa.
Well, as our skills, our recovery skills improve over time, we've been able to recover tinier and tinier samples of seeds, get more and more. You can get good dates off of now tiny little bits of charred matter. We know that some of the earliest agriculture, we know for sure there was really good evidence at the Gast Spring site in Loayza County, where they had excavated a large pit that contained squash and goosefoot and little barley. These are the local native plants that had been and all show evidence of having been domesticated. And then we find...
And with that site, approximately when does that site date to?
That site's at least 3,000 years old. And we have a few little bits of earlier stuff that over here in Johnson County at the Edgewater Park site. There's material that's about 4,000 years old, 3,800. We found recovered little barley, domesticated plants, and that seed... They were probably not growing it there. It looks like it was a temporary camp of travelers or traders that were moving up and down the Iowa River and carrying some of these domestic seeds with them. So they might have been trading for them or bringing them up from the Illinois bottoms or something like that. So we know that even if they weren't growing it themselves that early, they had access to it. They knew about agricultural plants. There's also a squash rind at another site in Loayza County, which dates back about 4,000 years. So we know it was pretty early.
And let's talk a little bit about some of the tools that allow us to know these things, because there has been a lot of advancement in the kinds of things that archaeologists can know when they're exploring sites these days. And Bruce, I'll let you respond to that, because so much of this information, while not brand new, I mean, has been uncovered in the last 15 to 20 years.
Right. One of the big breakthroughs that Sherry referred to is the development of a new technique of radiocarbon dating called accelerator mass spectrometer dating. And before this was developed in the early 1980s, if you wanted to figure out how old a squash rind or a little barley seed was, you would have to find a big chunk of charcoal that was spatially in association with it in the archaeological site, hopefully close to it horizontally and also in the same layer or the same archaeological feature. And then you would date it, and then you would date the domesticate by association with that larger piece of charcoal. And that often caused problems in that these little tiny feet can move up and down in deposits, so sometimes they would turn out to be much more recent or much earlier than the date on the big piece of charcoal. Then in the 1980s, they developed small sample radiocarbon dating where you could, if you found a domesticated squash seed, you could take a little part of it, and now we can, there are commercial firms, you can mail it off to Beta Analytic in Florida and pay them $500, and they'll send you back a radiocarbon date for that material within a couple of weeks. So that's really helped, in particularly in the kinds of finds that Sherry referred to, where often when you excavate archaeological sites, you'll only find a few battered fragments of early domesticated plants. So you really don't, it's a lot of small information points on a large map, and if you can get the date, a big benefit to figuring out what the timing of domestication was in different parts of the world. Then the other big thing that's happened in the last 15 years is the geneticists have begun to really get interested in looking at archaeological specimens of early domesticates, particularly in dry caves. If the archaeobotanical material or assemblages aren't burned, then you can take a small seed now and send it to a genetics laboratory in Copenhagen or in California or all over the world now, and they will extract the ancient DNA from it, and they can compare it to modern corn or squash, and they can look at how much genetic changes has occurred over period of time and can actually trace the change in particular genes up through time from initial domestication.
Well, and Sherry, with the things that we've found in Iowa over the years, are archaeologists in Iowa pursuing, you know, rechecking some of those finds? Is that possible? I mean, I know that once you do the excavation, things change, but...
Well, one of the things, the other recovery techniques that has been developed and refined in the last couple of decades is the water flotation, where we actually save samples of the soil from a feature. We process it through water. I mean, when I was a graduate student, we would stand out in a river or a creek and do it, and that probably didn't do much for a sample of our little seeds and things like that. But now we have a machine that we can do it right here in our lab, and the thing won't be contaminated with outside materials. Recovering those recovery techniques, I mean, the seeds of echinopod are tiny. Think like poppy seeds. You really have to sit down with a microscope and sort through them and pick out those little guys.
Right.
We are much more thorough now in our recovery techniques, and we're always getting more and more detail that way.
We're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Sherry Howery, arts archaeologist and an education and outreach associate with the Office of the State Archaeologist in Iowa. Also, Bruce Smith is here, curator of North American archaeology at the Smithsonian Institution. And you can join the conversation as well. 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the origins of agriculture all over the world. We've talked for years about the Fertile Crescent, but now we know that agriculture was independently invented at least 11 times on 4 different continents, not just in that Fertile Crescent in the Middle East. With me this hour, Bruce Smith, curator of North American archaeology at the Smithsonian Institution, and Sherry Howery, arts archaeologist and an education and outreach associate with the Iowa Office of the State Archaeologist. And Sherry, when we approached you about being on this program, your first response was, "How is this still news?" So tell us a little bit about why that was your response.
Well, it's because I study archaeology, so I've been familiar with the literature for a while. I think part of it is you were talking earlier about how hard it is to get a curriculum to change, and textbooks are notoriously slow. Part of the other thing I think we make a mistake of. And I was just in a classroom last week where I picked up a book off the shelf and it started talking about primitive societies. And I think when we associate that word with pre-industrial people, it changes the way we think about them. We think the hand-to-mouth subsistence, the long struggling existence, they weren't primitive in that sense of the word at all. They were intimately familiar with their environment and the plants and animals in it. And so when you stop and think about it that way, it's not a surprise that they recognized that you could help plants along, that you could water plants, that you could save certain kinds of seeds and grow bigger and better plants. They were intelligent human beings, and they could figure these things out. They weren't, you have the picture of the caveman, the early Neanderthal guy, dragging his knuckles and grunting. It wasn't like that at all.
Well, and Bruce, what's your response? I mean, why does it take so long for information like this, not just to get out, because I know that it gets out, but for it to actually take hold and become part of the narrative that people understand about our history?
Right. I think a lot of it is the time lag, as Sherry mentioned, of research developments are pretty fast moving, and new information is coming out all the time. And we're getting a much more detailed understanding of the transition from hunting and gathering to domestication to shift to agricultural economies in a lot of different areas of the world. But when it comes to textbooks, you need to have a relatively short and simple story to present. So it's often not until you get to graduate school or to upper-level classes as an undergraduate that you start to run into all of the complexities that are involved.
And, of course, most of us don't get to studying archaeology in graduate school.
Right.
And so why do you think it's important to have a conversation like this? Why do we need to know that there were origins of archaeology all over the world, Bruce?
Well, I think it's just interesting to know what the history is and try to understand. For me, the really interesting thing is if you think about these 11 different independent areas of initial domestication and agricultural origins, they provide a great comparative set for comparing different areas and looking at what different species of plants and animals were domesticated, what the sequence was, what the timing was, and why certain species were selected or became domesticates and others didn't. It's a great sort of intellectual enterprise of learning about our distant past and what our ancestors were up to.
Well, and Cherie, I know you do a lot of educational outreach. When you, of course, you don't have all the time in the world. You can't tell the most complicated story every time you get in front of a room full of kids or adults even. What do you feel are the most important takeaway lessons from this information?
Well, I think that I'm trying to change the attitude. People look at our ancestors, at pre-industrial societies, especially since I work in North America and I deal with pre-industrial societies, were Native American societies. And I think I try and get people to understand, how intelligent these people were, how well they had a good control of what was going on in their lives. It was different from the way we do things, but that doesn't necessarily mean it was any more primitive or something like that. It's they were intelligent, knowledgeable people. They living an interesting existence.
And we've talked a lot about growing crops and how plant domestication developed over time. We haven't talked as much about animal domestication, which of course is an incredibly important part of agriculture. And Cherie, we didn't do a lot of animal domestication here in North America, did we?
No. Prehistorically, domestic dogs was about it in North America. In some places in Central and South America, you have evidence there might have been things like guinea pigs that they might have kept corralled as a food source. But not necessarily, but they had an abundant supply of meat. This was a very rich environment with bison and deer and all kinds of small animals, ducks and swans and geese, and apparently not something that was necessary.
Interesting. Well, and Bruce, I mean, we think about domestic food animals as a later add-on to agriculture, but there is evidence of maybe not early domestication, but early animal husbandry. Can you give me an example of that?
Sure. The Near East is probably the best known region in that regard. And we now know there that plants and animals were in fact domesticated at about the same point in time, about 10 to 11,000 years ago. The oldest domestic animals in the Near East, other than the dog, which really wasn't a food source early on, were sheep and goats. And one of the interesting developments is now a new way of finding evidence for initial domestication of sheep and goats. And that has to do with the looking at assemblages of sheep and goat bones from the Near East and looking at the relative representation of males and females in the bone assemblage and their relative age. And we can see a shift in the pattern that you would get if they were hunting sheep and goats, where there's pretty equal distribution of males and females, maybe a predominance of males. But then when they shift over to herding, they do exactly what farmers or animal husbandry people do today. They kill off most of the males when they get to be about a year old, and they keep just a few males around and a lot of females in the herd. And you can see a shift in 10,000-year-old animal bone assemblages and theories that shift from hunting to herding.
And we seem to be losing our phone connection with you, Bruce. Can you still hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, good. There you are. There was also some evidence of early people not just managing a population, but possibly moving animals so that they had animals available to hunt, which is, again, not the same as raising livestock, but it's still a very interesting thing. The evidence comes from New Guinea and some remote islands near there. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Oh, I don't know so much about the New Guinea evidence, but I do know in the eastern Mediterranean, Cyprus, there's evidence of human societies moving wild animals out to Cyprus by 10 to 11,000 years ago and populating the island with deer and other and wild oxen and other species. So they were, and certainly early on, domesticated animals were traded and moved around the European basin very early. So there is good evidence of that sort of repopulating or establishing colonies of both wild and domestic animals, sort of taking their animals with them.
We're talking about the origins of agriculture this hour. With me, Bruce Smith, curator of North American archaeology at the Smithsonian Institution, Cherie Howery Arts, archaeologist and education and outreach associate with the Iowa Office of the State Archaeologist, is also here. And we're getting close to the end of the hour, Bruce, but something that is very interesting to look at is how once humans started using agriculture to feed themselves and agricultural societies and economies arose, our relationship as human beings with the land that we lived on seemed to change at that point. And we really, in your words, actually kind of divorced ourselves from the natural cycle of things.
Right. There's been the recent discussion of the need for a new geological epoch designation of the Anthropocene, and the usual criteria used for identifying the onset or beginning of the Anthropocene is when humans significantly began to impact their environment.
And of course, the Anthropocene, the age of man.
Yeah, I'm sorry, you're breaking up a little bit.
All right. So I was just defining the term Anthropocene. So go on with what you were saying about how our definition is changing.
Right. Most archaeologists would argue that if you want to use the concept of the Anthropocene in a good way, you could push it all the way back to the beginning of the Holocene 10,000 years ago. Because archaeologists spend a lot of time and are very interested in looking at all of the different ways humans have impacted environments, so in both a bad way and a good way over the last 10,000 years. And I think the development of domestics and agriculture really is the major lever by which human populations have modified the
earth. Interesting. Well, and Bruce, I am having a harder time understanding you. I'm going to turn to you, Cherie. And let's take an example from North America that a lot of people have talked about, because a lot of people have visited the site at Mesa Verde in Colorado, which, you know, historically, I guess we've called the people who live there the Anasazi, and there are other maybe more accurate names that archaeologists use to talk about that group of people. But these are the cliff dwellers. And when I visited that site and toured the site, one of the stories that was told was that, you know, this was an agricultural people and they used up the land. And then also they said they disappeared and we don't know where they went. But so now we know a lot more about what actually happened there. But it fascinated me at that point to think about early people using the land to the point where it was no longer fertile.
Well, I'm not sure that that's really the case. Mm-hmm. People are responding to changes in their environment. If they've become reliant on a certain kind of agriculture and it becomes too dry or they require more space or something, they'll pick up and move. I mean, that was the easiest way to do it.
And of course, the land was available
right,
to do
exactly.
That, not something we can do today.
They also may have been social things that changed. Those cliff dwellings that they were living at Mesa Verde are easily defensible. They are up hanging off a cliff. If you don't need to you know, if your enemies aren't lurking that closely and you can live out in the open up on the top, you don't have to climb up and down those cliffs all the time. It might have been a logical reason to move. But we now recognize that the Anasazis are ancestral to the Pueblo. So they didn't disappear. They just moved. You also have to understand that when we're looking at things prehistorically, it's like we're looking at a tapestry through tiny little pinholes of archaeological sites. So we define a culture based on their physical attributes, what their pottery looked like, what their houses looked like, things like that. And when those things change, we don't recognize them archaeologically anymore. And we'll make up a new term for what we do recognize. And then as we get more and more of those little pinholes and we begin to be able to put together the whole story, we can see the connections between groups like that. So, you know.
We have a question from Michelle in Urbandale who called, and we talked earlier about the fact that most of us don't make it to graduate level courses where, where this kind of information is taught. Do you have, either one of you, a good resource for lay people on this history, Cherie?
Well, people are interested in what went on in Iowa. We have a nice website for the Office of the State Archaeologist. And if you just go to your search engine and look up Crops of Ancient Iowa, this was grant-funded research that was funded by the Leopold Center a number of years ago. You can click on each one of the different plants and learn about what evidence we have for them in Iowa. You can see pictures of what they look like and pictures of what the archaeological evidence looks like. You can follow the links from that one. You can read more detail about the Edgewater Creek site and things like that. That's a real easy reference.
Yeah. Bruce, what about you? Where would you tell people to turn if they're interested but not looking for a graduate level education?
All right. I think another good website they could look search for our website at the National Museum of Natural History, Department of Anthropology. We have a program in human ecology and archaeobiology there that has profiles of the different scientists in our program and research articles they can get and descriptions of the kind of work we're interested in doing on origins of domesticates and agriculture.
You know, knowing that in the last 15 years or so, archaeologists have learned so much about this subject and so much that rewrites the story of history that so many of us were taught. Bruce, do you feel like there's still that much more out there to be discovered?
Oh, yeah, there sure is. And it's attracting the general research area or enterprise of agricultural origins is attracting more archaeologists and geneticists, all biologists all the time, because new areas of the world are opening up for research really for the first time, like China, where up until 5 or 6 years ago there was really hardly anything in detail known, and now there's lots of people very interested in looking at early history of plant and animal domestication in East Asia.
Well, Bruce, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Oh, you're very welcome. It was a pleasure.
Bruce Smith, Curator of North American Archaeology at the Smithsonian Institution. And Cherie, just quickly before I let you go, Iowa's landscape has been altered so dramatically by agriculture. Do we still have these things out there to excavate and discover?
Oh, yes. In fact, up in O'Brien County, we have a raised field site where we could actually still see the ridges that the people developed for their agriculture. Yeah,
okay.
It's still out there.
Wonderful. Cherie Howery, Arts Archaeologist and an Education and Outreach Associate with the Iowa Office of the State Archaeologist. Cherie, thank you so much.
Sure.
Talk of Iowa is produced by Lindsay Moon, Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.